welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, and welcome back to Turn the Page. I am Lisa, here with Stacy and...
Hi.
And author Ann Leary. And Ann has a book coming out on May 31st called The Foundling. And I will just let her say a little bit about the book now and, you know, just give us a little background on it. Okay, the floor is yours, Ann.
Thank you, Lisa. Okay, well, thank you for having me on your podcast. My new book is a novel. It's called The Foundling. And it's my fourth novel, but it's my first historical fiction work, you would say. I didn't set out to write this book. I was doing family. I got really caught up in the genealogy ancestry craze about a decade ago. I was finishing another novel. And all I really wanted to know was how my grandmother became an orphan. I never knew why she grew up in an orphanage, what happened to her mother. I still don't know the answer to that. But what I did find was the first record I could find of my grandmother, whose name was Mary Rauschmeyer. In 1930, she was employed at a place called the Laurelton State Village for feeble-minded women of childbearing age. And that was in Pennsylvania. My grandmother was a stenographer and she was 17 years old. And I thought, okay, that's not a very the longest, most off-putting name of a place I've ever seen. So I had, of course, to find out all about it. I found out that feeble-minded was in those days not, it wasn't really a slur. It was actually a clinical term, as were the words moron and imbecile and idiot. Those were actually the way they classified levels of intellectual disabilities. The part I thought was the most offensive was this feeble-minded business. But what I found out was the part that was the most shocking was the of childbearing age part of the name of the place. Because what I found out was Laurelton State Village at that time, it later became a different kind of place, but at that time it was founded as a eugenics asylum and it was one of many in the United States in the early 20th century. I went down a rabbit hole of research. I love to research. I'm super curious and I love history. So I read everything I could. And then final draft of my last novel, got in my car and I drove to central Pennsylvania to find out about this place. And I went to Harrisburg to look in the state archives. And then I actually went back and I spent years researching and writing this book. I originally was going to write a nonfiction kind of book of discovery about this, about what I found out, more of a journalistic kind of endeavor. But I actually then realized a few characters came to me. And honestly, I didn't know my grandmother very well growing up. She was dead when I found this out about her. And according to my mother, she was my maternal grandmother. She never spoke of working there. So I really had to fill in the blanks and I really was able to. What was fascinating, there were many fascinating things, but so many things that I found out on newspaper archives and in the records of this asylum and many other asylums. And there have been many books written about the eugenics era, even though we are not still probably taught that in our own public schools, that part of our history, which was a very big part of our American history. So I was able to fill in a lot of the blanks with things I found out about, true historic characters. And two very compelling characters came to me that were based on real characters, my grandmother and the superintendent of the asylum, whose name was Dr. Mary Wolfe, the real person. The head of the asylum in my novel is Dr. Vogel. She is loosely based on the real character. She's actually based on a few people. Margaret Sanger would be one, and a few other prominent women of that time. Then the others came to me from what I learned. I found out women were there who were certainly not intellectually disabled. It was more of a home for what they called moral defectives. They were more kind of delinquent young women. And the whole, it wasn't a training school. The whole idea of the place was to prevent the wrong types of women from having children. It was the eugenics crusade was all about kind of improving the American population, actually improving the race that was deemed the superior race at the time of American white Christians, and by preventing the wrong types from, you know, having children. And they, so the way they would do that is either through sterilization, which was not legal in many states, but mostly with young women, it was by putting them in asylums. The truth is, this book is set in the 1920s. In the 1920s, if you were a rich young woman, you could be who I always associated with the 1920s. You could be, Zelda Fitzgerald. You could be a flapper. You could be wild and crazy. You could be Brett Ashley from, The Sun Also Rises. You could have lovers. You could be an alcoholic. If you were poor, if you were rich and those were your behaviors, you were kind of seen as eccentric and kind of fabulous. If you were poor, you were seen as a menace to society. And the best thing to do would be to lock you away. And then you would be indebted to the state in Pennsylvania's case, the Commonwealth, for them keeping you there, and you'd have to work. You'd work in the asylum. They would farm these girls off to work in local industries and homes. So everything I learned was fascinating. Some of it was very dark. Some of it was hard to understand at first, and then it made more sense. And I'm still fascinated. I find out things every day still about the place where my grandmother worked, about other places just like it in the United States, Canada, and the UK. And our eugenics movement is what, eventually inspired the Nazis and Hitler with their Holocaust.
And I think the subject is timely now with the freedom of choice once again taking, center stage. Yeah. And these women had no choice when they're separated from society specifically so they don't have children. It's a different way of control.
Absolutely. So it was absolutely about women's reproductive rights. It was sort of a different angle on it. It was literally that these women had the right to be mothers was taken away from them. They didn't have that because they were deemed unfit to be mothers. They were criminality was quite linked with genetics through some kind of flawed sociology at the time, like the Kallikak and the Jukes studies. But if you were a mother, your child would be taken from you and you wouldn't be allowed. If you were sent there at 16, you had to stay till menopause. So it wasn't like a sentence for a crime. Even if you did a crime, you would stay until you could no longer have children. Women had no reproductive rights, but don't forget in those days, women had the right to vote, but they had few other rights. They were actually, they had the legal status of children, really. Married women were considered, their husbands were their guardians. If you were a doctor or a lawyer, your husband was kind of your legal guardian. You couldn't own a bank account. And then if you were not married, your father was such. So I think that, women had fewer rights in general, but certainly did not have reproductive rights. And one more thing I found out, and which was a big theme in this book, was that you didn't need a judge or even a doctor to be sentenced to stay at a place like this. Your husband who was sick of you, your uncle who has been molesting you, that you told on, anyone really, a man in the community or a woman could say that you were slow, and it would be, they would give you a very rudimentary IQ test and you could be sentenced to decades in one of these work farms.
Yeah. I mean, you said that in the book, and I was like, yeah, I could see that being possible. So, and I think that's why I was one of the characters that was intriguing to me was Dr. Vogel, because she seemed, you know, she came from money and she was educated and she was a doctor and she wasn't married. And she seemed so different than the other women in the book and other women in that time. And that could be one of the reasons why I felt like Mary really admired her, because she was different.
Yes, it was hard. You know, it was hard for me, you know, the main character, people very much, you know, in contemporary fiction, I think we've all gotten used to female protagonists are supposed to be our heroes. They're supposed to be people we admire. But, you know, my female narrator really is based on my grandmother. She was not she never went to college. She was very bright, but, you know, she was poor. She was an orphan. This was a great job for her. And she was 17 and she was raised by nuns. So she wouldn't have. And eugenics was the law of the land. It was not seen as, it was all, you know, very, you know, nothing, it wasn't a secret place. This was very well respected place. So she would have been probably in awe of a Dr. Vogel. The woman she worked for was quite like her. She was single. The Dr. Vogel in my novel is in her 40s. She's never married. She came from a wealthy family. And she went to medical school and graduated in, you know, right at the turn of the century. Yet if she had married, again, she would have had the legal status of a child. Her father was dead. So she actually did have more kind of agency than most women of her time. And she was a psychiatrist, and she decided to be the, you know, she was chosen to be the superintendent of this new asylum. She had been at a big state psychiatric hospital, and then she started this. It was a eugenics asylum, and there was no trying to, of course, there was nothing, they weren't trying to hide that people wanted these places. So it was specifically, as I said, it was a holding pen. It wasn't a place you went to get training or to get well, because there was no, you weren't really sick. You were just genetically inferior to the rest of the people in the community, either through your behavior or in some cases where my grandmother worked, there were some people who truly did have intellectual disabilities, but it seemed that that was a very small percentage in the early years.
And, you know, I feel like Mary came from a very awful family situation between her parents, her uncle, and even her aunt, who was just like, you know, when she left, she was just like, well, you're not coming back, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like she was either unwanted or taken advantage of by adults. And I think in this way, it made her like more sympathetic to the other girls that were there. It just seemed like, you know, she had the same kind of background as a lot of them. But, you know, I think she, you know, at first she was thinking it was the right thing to do. But then, she, you know, especially when she... we haven't really talked that much about, you know, Lillian.
Yeah.
But I think when she found that there were no test results for Lillian, that's when I think the doubt kind of like set.
Right. Yeah. So the big part of the plot is she arrives at this place, which is, she had grown up in Scranton, and this institution is in the middle of Pennsylvania. And she loves it. It's beautiful. And the real place that existed, it was a beautiful facility. You know,
it was just sold.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's free. You know, she's free of the aunt. She's free of the nuns. She has friends. She's got this wild friend who's a nurse, who's kind of a flapper, fun girl. She starts dating and she loves it. And she's very much in awe of her boss, Dr. Vogel. And, but very soon after she arrives, she is in the dining hall where the staff, you know, dine, and also the, what they called inmates in those days, they weren't called residents, they were called inmates. One of them who she recognizes is actually a childhood friend from the orphanage where she grew up. In those days, they called orphanages orphan asylums. It was so hard getting used to that. Some of the words seemed so, harsh, and they weren't. That's just the words they used at the time. So my grandmother and most orphans were also called inmates in orphan asylums. It didn't mean they were prisoners, but anyway. She sees Lillian. She doesn't understand why she's there. She doesn't remember Lillian having any kind of disability intellectually, but she hasn't seen her in a while. And she's told, you know, that the staff isn't allowed to, stay on if they have friends that are inmates there. And anyway, so that's kind of the problem she encounters very early on is, why is Lillian here? And when she talks to Lillian and finds out why she's there, it's very upsetting. But Lillian also seems a little bit, she seems unstable. And Mary remembers she was also quite impulsive, and she's learned a lot of what they called morally defective behavior. So she's sort of been brain, you know, she's drank the Kool-Aid of the eugenics movement about what makes a person morally or mentally inferior. And she thinks maybe Lillian is that. And so, ultimately she has to decide who's right? Who do I trust? This amazing doctor who's taken me under her wing and who wants to, help me, has offered to help me through college, or this kind of troubled friend from childhood. So that's the quandary.
And I loved the twist of the ending, which obviously I'm not going to ruin.
Spoilers.
I don't want to spoil.
No spoilers. I meant no spoilers. No, it sounds fascinating. Like I was a history major and I took a lot of American history classes. So, but you're spot on the mark when you say, like, we don't really learn about the movement in America. It's briefly touched upon. Like, I didn't really learn it until I was in college.
Yes, I learned it when my daughter was in college and she was in a women's studies class and writing a paper on eugenics. And I know a lot of people my age, we really weren't taught that. Now in the United Kingdom and Canada, they're taught it in public schools when they learn about the Holocaust. It really was a major movement. It was short lived. So, kind of the war came and people saw where this movement ends up, and nobody really wanted that. But at the time, it seemed like it was social Darwinism, basically. It made sense. It seemed very progressive. It seemed very scientific. And, I really then studied Margaret Sanger. She's been somebody who has been, and again, this is very much in the news right now, is the reproductive rights. And people have been this kind of, she was sainted and then she was vilified. And the truth is, and this really helped me with the Dr. Vogel character, you can't judge these women by our, by the standards of our time. Margaret Sanger, again, she could vote and she worked hard, rallied with the other women for the right to vote, her husband managed their money. If she got a divorce, she wouldn't be able to keep her kids. She didn't have many rights, but she was a nurse and she took care of women in tenements. And she saw what happened when women don't have the right to access to birth control and knowledge about birth control that wealthy women had. They knew, the educated women knew how to prevent births. And if they got pregnant, they could have access to, what was then, sometimes a healthy, much safer abortion than poor women had. So what she did was amazing, she was also, though, a eugenics, very strong eugenics proponent. But it was, I can't really apologize for that for her. If it weren't for, I read recently, somebody wrote, if it weren't for the eugenics movement, there'd be no Planned Parenthood. we love Planned Parenthood. And we have to get to a place. And I don't know if it's an American thing or just a human thing where, heroes have to be heroes and villains have to be villains. And there's no way that a person can be, a kind of a multifaceted person who has done great things and who had kind of flawed thinking or flawed by today's standards, kind of ideologies.
Yeah, that's true. It's like there's no gray. It's like either black or white. It's like
there is gray. And so I that was really a struggle. I also wanted people to buy this book, and I couldn't, I realized it seems like a dark subject, you know, this, it's set in an asylum, but it's set in the 20s. It's the jazz era. It's like it's my favorite era. And there's a very much, you know, a large part of the book is Mary, the main character, having fun, going to speakeasies as everybody did, going out to, you know, dance. And also Lillian, the reason she's there is she had, she was a very talented singer, and she had a baby that was with the man she wasn't married to. When the baby was born, he was obviously of mixed race. The man she was in love with was a Black musician. And that immediately qualified her as feeble-minded, because she was, you know, had, you know, if you had in those days, if you were a Caucasian woman and had sex with a Black man, again, if you were poor, something was considered wrong with, you know, you were just automatically feeble-minded. And so the baby was taken from her, and she was sent to this place again until her menopause. She was 20 when she went there.
It's interesting you say that about pointing out the fact that it was because if you were a poor woman and did that, because I'm just reminded of, I love Downton Abbey, so excited for the movie, but there's a character, Rose, and she's wealthy to do related to the family, and she kind of has a brief love affair with a Black man.
Yeah.
It's frowned upon, but it's just like, oh, okay, like, you know, she'll get it out of her system type thing.
Yes, I mean, you know, there was Cafe Society in Paris and Berlin, of course, before the war. You know, there were people with very, very, if you could be kind of a member of this kind of avant-garde artistic community that were very, you know, well-heeled. They were, you know, the writers and artists, and, you know, every behavior that might get you put in a eugenics asylum in, if you didn't have family or money, you could kind of do. It was considered, you know, quite, I mean, none of it was considered, it was considered eccentric, but it wouldn't get you, you know, necessarily locked up unless your family was very conservative, and then they'd put you probably in a private hospital. But it just was very, it's very, very hard reading the names of the inmates, as they were called, in the census records. The census records, if anyone is into genealogy, they come out every 10 years. And so I was, you know, my grandmother was in the 1930 records. And then I would see these girls, some of them, their mothers tried to get them out. They would try to do habeas corpus cases. You know, she's not feeble-minded. She just, you know, she was a prostitute when she was 18, as many poor girls were, in the industrial kind of revolution in these industrial times. Anyway, some of these mothers tried to get the girls out, and there were articles in the newspaper, and they always lost. And then I would look, and every decade they'd still be there. So like the mom would, one of them, the mother tried to get the girl out, and she was 18. And then the next census, she was 28, and then she was 38. It was hard to think of, you know, the problem, you know, these women were, they were denied everything. They had no, they were, everything was, their life was taken from them, their freedom. They could never have, you know, they had no freedom that our constitution, you know, is supposed to, you know, guarantee all Americans. They didn't, they were denied that.
Yeah. I also want to say, this is very exciting, but you got a starred review from Kirkus. Yeah. And in the library world, it is very hard to get a starred review. They said, Leary's wit complements her serious approach to historical and psychological issues in this thoroughly satisfying novel. To them, that is high praise. So as library people, we are very excited when we see something.
Yeah, like I was so happy. And everyone, Kirkus and Publishers Weekly are the kind of the early, you know, the two of the, you know, pre-publication reviews. Then, you know, I've been working on this for 6 years. I had no idea if people would get it or like it or hate it or be offended by it. And so I really was satisfying that they did get it. And I also, and I like that they mentioned the wit, you know, there, it is a dark topic, but I liked, you know, I feel like my grandmother had a sense of humor, I'm told. And I feel that, you know, I had to have some, there's, you know, these people are in the 20s. There's fun. They have fun. Women, young women together always have fun in my experience. Unless, you know, they're locked in an asylum. even then, I think even then you see scenes where it's a little Orange is Black. You see a little bit of the interaction between the inmates, and you kind of feel like at least they have each other.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us. And I am very excited that to get this book in the hands of my patrons here at the library. I'll be highly recommending it.
I really appreciate it. And I'm so pleased that you have this podcast. Do a lot of libraries have podcasts now? Or
They're becoming a lot more popular.
Uh-huh. But it's fabulous.
We started it like years ago.
A couple of years ago, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And then did it become big during COVID? Was it yeah.
It definitely got bigger during COVID, since a lot of authors, like usually at the library, we have like author visits in person where like, you know, the author will come talk about their book, do a Q&A, sell their book. And, you know, with COVID, people weren't traveling. So it became a lot of like, oh, we could do virtual programming. And it was just like, oh yeah, like I'd love to talk about my book. I love doing these because I love, you know, coming across like books that I might not have necessarily like went after, but I have to say, I'm very excited for your book because it's right up my alley.
Oh, good. I feel, again, this is my first, you know, the book isn't coming out for 3 weeks. This is my first kind of book.
What I loved about it is I love historical fiction and I love like psychological suspense. And I think it mixes both genres a little bit. I mean, obviously it's more historical, but the fact is you're like, you want to know about this whole Lillian thing. It's like on the edge of your seat, you just like kind of can't.
Yes. So
I love the fact that there's both things in there.
Well, I also, there's nothing in this book. This is a novel. So it's really, there's nothing, you know, none of the people, and I do an author's note at the beginning, you know, the kind of, you know, this is not, you know, this is based on all these characters are from my imagination, but there's nothing in the pages of this novel that is, that didn't happen just, you know, in one form or another, at the asylum where my grandmother worked or others I read about. So I made up you see what I'm saying? Like the plot is fiction,
Yes. But
I certainly didn't, you know, the things that happened there were real.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode. Thank you.